Welcome to the Everesting Podcast, built by Quarry. In this episode, I am hosting a listener who wrote in, and I read an extensive portion of his email back on episode 39 with respect to planning the Everesting Rome, as well as what are possibly some of the fastest times out there. And his name is Phil Rhodes, and it was super, super fun to have Phil on. He is a huge asset to the Everesting community. Very smart, analytical person, like a lot of Everesters. And something about the Rome has really captured his imagination and triggered a passion, which you can hear in the episode. Super fun chat. So thank you, Phil, for doing this and putting in a lot of time into analyzing this. And for anybody who's thinking about taking on this version of the Everesting Challenge, this is an awesome episode and will definitely give you some insight as to how you might look at some of the logistical challenges of a Rome, but also your precious kilometer to meter gained ratio and how not to overcook that and sort of make those two things line up. So super fun chat. Hope that you enjoy it. And I hope that I can have Phil back on probably after he completes another Rome this summer. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the State Bicycle Company. You can check State out at statebicycle.com. Right now, you can use code AUDIO100, which will give you $100 off of a bicycle. They have bicycles starting at $399, so that's a pretty great deal. They also have a carbon fiber road frame out now too, which looks just terrific, undefeated. So check them out, statebicycle.com. Give them a follow on social media. That's how you can stay up to date with what they're doing and all of their current promotions. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you're able to give us a positive rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're finding the show, that helps us grow. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back soon.
One of the most fun things for me, Phil, about the show is that people can reach out and connect, and we can connect with people all over the world who are interested in this stuff, which is really, really neat. So, and there was something that we did on the show, particularly, that sort of struck a chord with you, which was discussing Rome, right? So, yes. Yeah, you reached out and admitted that Everesting in its traditional format was not particularly captivating to you, but there was something about the Rome that was. And then when we started talking about the planning of Romes and the ability to do them quickly, that kind of sent us, you, I, Ronan McLaughlin, down a bit. I'm sure Andy a little bit in the background too, down a bit of a rabbit hole here. So tell me about your introduction to the challenge in the first place, and your Rome, and then we can talk about, or plural, and then we can talk about, and you also live in a really good part of the world for it, it seems like too, so we can get into that too. But take me back to when you first heard about it and decided to take it on for yourself.
Sure. Well, when I was first exposed to Everesting, I didn't even know that the Rome existed, because, you know, the 8848 was what I learned of first. And that was during the pandemic, you know, that stretch, March maybe to July, when the world record was getting knocked down, you know, once a month or sometimes more frequently. And so that's when I became aware of it. But it was kind of intimidating to me. I like to ride hills, but the idea of riding the same hill didn't switch me on. I wasn't sure if I could survive both the physical strain as well as the mental, sort of the mental, just everything being the same. And I wasn't sure if that combination was something that I could do. I knew I liked to do long rides, though. And so I hadn't really considered it till I saw somebody do an Everesting on a hill that I was familiar with. And I went out and rode it. And I thought, well, you know, I could do this maybe. And that's when I went to the website. And when I was on the website to say, well, maybe I'll try this 8848. I don't like the hairpin in that hill. I'll have to find my own hill. But when I got on the website, that's when I found the Rome, and immediately I was like, well, I can do that one first, because I, you know, it's basically just a super long ride, and it grabbed my imagination much more. Yeah. I subsequently have gone back and done the 8848, but it was the Rome that, when I saw that, I was like, okay, I can get at that and take a swing.
That was your gateway drug. So, which is different. It's usually the other way around. Usually people do an Everesting or a half Everesting and then work their way up to the Rome. And you've, in doing both, which one do you think, would you say one's harder, or they're hard in different ways?
They're hard in different ways. The Rome, logistically, the margin for error is much smaller. The amount of planning is considerably more complex. And the route mapping can get really involved. So I find that kind of a fun challenge. Other people who've been on the podcast have talked about just kind of loving maps and like the sort of being a bit of a map nerd also is part of the appeal of finding the Rome totally. And trying to find a route that matches.
And for that, if you like sitting down with a cup of coffee or a beer at night and looking at maps online for 2 hours and adding things up and checking Google versus Strava, and if that comment is resonating with people, that's who we're talking about, right?
That definitely, I think you and Sir Guy Lightspeed had talked about that, and that was something that I definitely drew me to it. I also used this one, it's a weird name, it's like PJAMM, PJAMM, like website that I think the name comes from some law firm on the West Coast, but the founder has this website where they do a lot of crowdsourcing, but also feature some information that came out of someone's book on best climbs of, you know, this region of the United States or that region. And so you could go on there and find, what does he think are the top 10 climbs, say in Pennsylvania or Virginia or Maryland? And then be like, okay, well, where are they? Now let me look at the segments on Strava. Let me see what I can link up together, if at all. But that was apart from Google Maps, Google Street View to look at things about road, it's out of date for road surface, but for shoulder, at least you can get good information and right. Strava mapping. You know, those were kind of the resources that I used to try to create some roams that I thought I could take a swing at.
Okay. And were you always strictly trying to keep it very close to the 400K, or did you in your head, like, where did you allow it to go up to? Because that's one of my challenges is, you know, for me, I think that 550 to 600K is like the very, which so 600K is like about 400 miles. That's like the very, very tip of what I think I could do for distance in 36 with that kind of climbing.
My first one, I mapped to 514 kilometers.
Okay.
And it ended up being 530 kilometers. And I finished in outside the time limit. I was finished that in 38 hours and 21 minutes. So that was, you know, not one to submit. It wasn't eligible. The second one, I mapped it for 450. It ended up being 466. And that's because my head unit tends to count. I don't know if it's an actual undercount, but it certainly has a variance with what Strava maps ahead of time. And so in both of those attempts, I've had an additional 500 meters to make up beyond the map route. So now when I plan a Rome route, I plan it to 10,500, the ones I'm planning for this summer. I'm mapping it to 10,500 meters. And if I can turn off the head unit sooner, I'll be happy. But when I've mapped it to like 10, both times that I've tried to execute it, I've had to then find extra vertical beyond what I had initially planned. And I think there's been some discussions of that on Facebook too.
Yes.
You know, what to do at the end. And that's been really helpful from the Paul Jones and some other people in the community.
I think psychologically, that's a really smart tactic because, man, 500 meters is a lot. If you've been riding like crazy for 2 days, that's still a lot to make up. So I think that you're sort of, it's like a cherry on top if you're there a little bit sooner instead of the other way around. So I think that's a wise tactic.
Now, the expectations game can be a big part of it.
100%, especially when you're really fatigued and you're just trying to check the box, right? It does sort of, our expectations sort of devolve as these things go along, right? So something that jumped out to you too, because like there's no doubt that the very fastest way that you could do a Rome would be to just do an Everesting and then bang out the required distance on flat-ish roads at the very end. That was probably the very fastest way to do it because you could just get a really, really steep hill and then you're eliminating all of trying to not use the flat roads in between, right? That's the biggest challenge is I wish that I could shrink some of these flat transfer sections that I have around me. But you and I and Sir Guy Lightspeed both and Ronan McLaughlin as well, feel strongly that the Rome is much more interesting if you don't do it that way. If you do in fact Rome, and stay true to sort of the name of it. It's within the rules to do it either way. And it's, look, I'm not taking one thing away from anybody who's done it that way. It's a gigantic bike ride.
There's still mighty efforts, no matter how you
describe it. Unbelievable, but there's something more interesting to me and captivating about doing it in that format. And something we seem to agree on is that, with a couple of caveats, one is to tack on that extra mileage at the end, or elevation rather, just to have your head unit agree that you've completed the challenge, really, which is more of a technicality. Also though, and I don't know if you did this in yours or not, but to have little branches off of your main tree. So you might go up a ski hill road here and then back down and then continue on your way. Did you do something like that?
The second one I did in the kind of the Catoctin Mountains, Blue Ridge Mountains, that are on the border of Pennsylvania and Maryland. And so the highest point is going to be like 708 meters around like McConnellsburg, Pennsylvania. And the other hills are like in the tops would be like maybe 550 meters. I live at 150 meters. So that's the baseline is like 150 meters. And for that, I had to maximize every opportunity to get up on a ridge, get down, and climb back up, because, you know, the climbs are not that long. And so for those, you know, you kind of get the spaghetti diagram where you're going along the ridgeline and then you go down and back up, and you continue along the ridgeline and go down and back up. And so I've done a lot of that. And so maybe there are some intersections where you come through the intersection again, but you haven't, you know, you're not repeating sort of there isn't a hill repeat.
Right.
One place that I have some, maybe more latitude on the repeats is for including, say, you can repeat it one time. So you could do like a segment or a climb twice if it is part of two longer climbs, right? So like if there's a climb from the east side of the ridge that ends at the summit, and then you go down the west side of the ridge and climb up to the same point. And maybe at the top, you know, there's a single segment or uphill that you've repeated, but you've said, I'm repeating this as part of two longer segments or climbs that I'm each doing once. Like I have a lot of, if you do that, you open up more topography for a Rome, in my opinion, on the low mountains, low hills that I have around here.
And there may be some opportunities, depending on how they build road networks around where you live in whatever part of the world, where you may climb up to an alpine town, go in one direction, complete a loop, and then go back up to that same town and go in a different direction. That, to me, again, that's within sort of the idea and the spirit. And it's not to nitpick anybody's effort. It's just that's what I would consider to be acceptable. Not riding from one hill and doing 10 repeats and then riding to another hill and doing 11. And I've thought about that, and you know, never say never. I could maybe be compelled in a charity challenge or something like that. But when I stay up late at night by myself looking at Google Maps, that's not what I'm looking at, right?
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. The one thing that I do try to take into account when I'm mapping it is thinking about, for lack of a better term, climbing density. And I think Ronan alluded to this as well, the meters per kilometer, and thinking about that as a metric for how I'm conceptualizing the challenge and the possibilities of a route. And so, you know, 400 kilometers, 10,000 meters, you know, that's 25 meters per kilometer that you would get as an overall average if you were just going to hit the 10,000 and the 500, the 400 kilometers and the 10,000.
But right. As if you could nail it. Yeah.
You nailed it. And so when I'm looking at a route, and even when I'm riding in preparation to do one, you know, I'm looking to like, does this have at least, you know, I mean, a minimum of 18 meters, say, per kilometer? If it's 20, 21, you know, if you're practicing those the day of, you can do more, I think, in my opinion. And then also breaking the Rome down into kind of bricks, like about 100 kilometer bricks, and saying, okay, like the first 100 kilometer, that climbing density or that meters per kilometer is X. Like maybe it's 21, maybe it's 25, you know, like, and thinking about the 100-kilometer bricks in your route. If it's more than 500, then you have a fifth brick, and saying, okay, like, how does that correspond to my preparation and what I think I can ride at the kind of speed that is going to be necessary to finish it. But I kind of, that meters per kilometer is something that I spend a lot of time paying attention to when I'm trying to map a route, especially now that I'm trying to do them shorter, just to see what I could possibly do toward the shorter end of a route.
Yeah, well, like, look, the shorter it is, you just, your margin for error opens up so much to mechanicals and rest. So if you start putting yourself up against the time limit for distance, which if I'm ever able to complete one anywhere near me, it's definitely going to be on the longer end of things, which I'm willing to accept, but I just have to know that there's a whole bunch of ways that it could go wrong. So the first one that you completed, you did for distance, and then the second one you completed for distance, time, and elevation. So that's like the big check mark. Mm-hmm. And how much shorter are you trying to go this time? Are you trying to get it right to about 400K?
I'm trying to get it right at 400K. I feel like that's to figure out what I'm capable of. After the one that the first one was 38:21 with the 530 kilometers. The one that was 466 was not, I didn't make it by much. It was like 34:28. But both times I stopped for more than 6.5 hours overnight, and I slept very little. Like, I maybe got 2 hours of sleep. Like, you know, you wash up, you fix the bike, you do it. And so I'm curious to see what I can do. What are my limits in terms of just doing one continual effort? And I think for me, I'll try to keep my time as low as I can. And that means as short and as steep as a route as I can. I may find that I learned something new and that 400 is not what I can hit, but I've been mapping them to the best I can with my topography, hit right at 400 and then continuing them to about 412 kilometers to hit that 10,500 to have the
right
additional to know where I'm going if it's low, if the head unit is reading lower, and to know that my route will have the vertical there, because sometimes you get to the end of your route and like, okay, but this is now flat, right? What do I do?
And you're exhausted and you're like, what should I do now? Right. And you're looking around for hills thinking, what we should do now. Yeah. That makes sense.
That was my first experience. I made lots of mistakes the first time, but the first time, one of the things that I ended up not conceptualizing was that I was up on a ridgeline already. And I could ride as much as, my legs felt decent, but I just couldn't find the vertical. And I did not think that the only way to even correct for all the errors I had made already was to find roads that drop to the valleys on either side and come back up, instead of just plowing forward along a ridgeline where they're just, you know, it was
undulating
in a way that just, you know, it was something to keep in mind that if you're a little low, if you feel or fear that you could be a little low at the end, saving some planned topography to make up the difference. Hopefully, you know, stand you in good stead if that does actually transpire.
Yeah. And it's so much harder than people realize. Like 10,000 meters is so much to find on roads. It's so, so much, especially if you're, Sir Guy and I talked about this for sure, about I love riding gravel. Gravel's awesome, but you're paying a big time tax on it. And we have some very steep gravel roads, lots of fire lookouts. They don't ultimately go anywhere, but you could do lots of them, but you pay a lot back in time. So it's very limited, and it's a challenge I put out to people to just map out some routes that you think would include the biggest hills around you, and you'd be surprised how short it leaves you. You know, it's pretty interesting. So are you thinking about going no sleep on your next attempt? Just going right through.
Yeah.
That's what it sounded like.
Yeah. I'm my goal for the next one, when I finished the last one, the first one, I was a buddy of mine from an old college roommate was too good of a friend to turn me down on being the ride support for it. But you know, he's not an endurance athlete. I had, of course, overplanned and sent him a big Google Doc ahead of time with lots of details. But you know, he happened to read that the first morning while he was driving, or while in between driving. And so there are lots of things that could be optimized from that experience, from what I did, what he did. And then when the second one was kind of more semi-support, I met a support vehicle a few times a day at pre-planned locations to just be like, oh,
okay. You know.
So I met up with a vehicle 4 times on the first day and once on the second day. And I chose that route. So I also had, unlike the first one, that one had, I could map it around convenience stores and things like that, because the first one was in a national park setting that just didn't have that kind of infrastructure to map into your route.
Right. I wanted to ask about that, because I think that's, you know, like, are you fully self-supported, or are you getting changes of bibs and fuel reloads and stuff like that?
The two that I've done before, I have done that overnight, and the shower has felt amazing. So I will miss the shower and the change of kit. But at the speeds that I ride and the kind of climbing density that would be required to finish under 24 hours, I need to keep the non-moving time to under 2 hours for the entire thing. I need to ride for 22 of the 24 hours. And I don't think that's going to allow me, even as much as I would love a shower somewhere in there, to even, you know, duck out for a shower.
Well, to try and do it in 24 is, I mean, now you're very much doing it like an Everest thing. Yeah. In terms of the feel and really shortening up those breaks and stuff like that. Okay. So something else that was really interesting that you did, and I'm already going to tell you this, I want to have you back on after you do your next one this summer for sure, because this is a really fun conversation. But something you did was you delved into a little bit of some of the existing Rome results in the Hall of Fame. So can you share with us what you found, and like what's sort of the tip of the spear-ish? I know that they're not perfect. And because of the variance in the way that people have done the challenge, there's obviously a really big variance in time. And even the way that some of the calculations seem to have come through, it does seem that there's some errors. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to hear what you found about what's quick, and what have you supplied Ronan McLaughlin with? Like, what is he targeting here?
Well, I can't speak to what he's targeting, but I can tell you what I found.
Okay.
And you know, Ronan, we're really lucky to have him active in the community, because he is, you know, he's this great combination of hill climb nerd and time trial dork. And
I know
for the Rome, you know, it's that combination that I think is really ideal. I saw, you know, he had all, of course, the Everesting stuff, but I think over the past summer he did a time trial between two cities in Ireland in under 6 hours. And when I saw that one, thinking back to his Everesting, I was like, that guy, you know, has both like the technical skills and just the mind that likes these challenges, both sides of the climbing, and like, how do you finish this as rapidly as possible? If there's a flat, he's going to optimize, you know, to deal with that. And he's more than capable in the climbs. And, you know, I mean, he's an ex-pro, he's a professional cycling coach. He knows, you know, he's a tinkerer. It's a great combination. And if there are other people who run for his money, I'd love it too. But I became very interested in what's the fastest Rome out there. It's not something I can challenge, but just knowing kind of what the edge of good logistics, good execution, good performance can yield is interesting for me, no matter how long it takes me to finish it.
Exactly. Agreed.
I tried to, you know, do a search through the Hall of Fame. And then when people had public Strava to go in and look back at their Strava rides, which was real fascinating to see all of the great, you know, legwork that is pulled in this community. And say, like, well, does the Hall of Fame entry match the Strava, what's on Strava? And of course, on Strava, you can't tell when someone gets to 10,000 meters. So that wasn't sort of part of it at all. It was just like, well, when did the person get to 400 kilometers as a minimum? You know, and right. I'm sure other people had, you know, maybe head unit problems or other things that Andy might have been adjudicating on the side that aren't even reflected in anything when you peep on right. somebody's Strava account. So I don't want to claim that what I dug up is the be all end all. I think Andy's record
is based on available data.
But what I found was the fastest Rome that involves, say, 75 or 80% hill repeats on a single hill was about 17. It was a bit over 17 hours. I wrote it down, 1726. And that was like a 20 kilometer ride to the hill, 20 plus really demanding hill repeats, and then a 20 kilometer ride back. And so that was
okay.
1726.
But it looked structurally very much like an Everest thing. They just happened to commute by bicycle to start.
Yeah, I mean, they met the 400 and the 10,000. But in terms of the idea that this is a sprawling adventure of sorts, it doesn't quite match up with what might be the Platonic ideal of the Rome to me.
Right.
And then the fastest one that I was able to confirm in the Hall of Fame that did that was one from a ultra distance cyclist racer in Alabama named Brian Toon. And in the Hall of Fame, it lists the moving time, but his total elapsed time, I think, was 1827. 1827. And that, for the Rome of the sort that we've been banding about back and forth, right now, that's the fastest one I could confirm from the Hall of Fame. There are two or three entries that are in that between 1726 and 1827 in the Hall of Fame that are private, and I don't know what exists there. So if that's one of yours,
if you're listening, that
would be faster than the 1827. But I just, you know, there's some in there that I could confirm by what was public on Strava, and there are others that there are a few times that could be faster ones. I just couldn't review them. And so many of there are some broken connections right now in the Hall of Fame between rides and the data that's there that will, I think, eventually be cleared up. But it makes it a little difficult to parse out what's the fastest. But I would say between 17 and a half and 18 and a half hours are the two marks that I could confirm. And 18 and a half was what I threw to Ronan as, you know, kind of if he's looking to set the fastest time, 18 and a half would be the fastest for a Rome like route that is currently confirmable from what I could see.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I mean, I can't wait to see what Ronan does. He lives in a great part of the world for it, it seems. If anybody is going to optimize their chances at being successful in this, it's Ronan. You're right, pro level talent and an amateur's enthusiasm. Like he's the best. Yeah, he's awesome. And speaking of Ronan, just a quick shout out to Escape Collective, which he and a whole bunch of a group from former Cycling Tips folks have launched. If anybody's listening and haven't checked out Escape Collective, I hope they can do that, because that's a really cool group of people in the cycling world who need some support to get something really cool off the ground. Phil, thank you for doing this, man. What a pleasure. I want to have you back for sure. When are you planning your next attempt? Or are you just kind of watching for weather? And you're getting into a nice time of year in your part of the world.
Yeah, we are. I'm hoping to do this the first week in June.
Okay, soon. Getting,
you know, close to the solstice and also the benefit of the full moon the first week of June. So it'll either the first week in June or the first week of July, because there's another full moon that week. And those are the closest full moons to the longest daylight period of the year. So those are the time frames I'm looking at.
If you're not planning to sleep, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah,
that's my daylight.
That's I'm not a great descender as it is. And descending in the dark is not something that I do without a little hesitation. So having as much daylight and as much moonlight, depending on cloud cover, is something that I want to have on my side to the greatest degree possible.
I think that's smart. Thank you again for doing this. Please stay in touch. I'd love to hear how the prep is going and the attempt itself. So good luck and stay safe, and we'll try and chat soon, okay?
Thanks, Pete. And thanks to everybody on the Facebook group. Like, that's a great community of motivation and also great advice. And I rely on that a lot. So big thanks to anybody from that Facebook group that gives this a listen, because I've certainly gotten a lot more out of that than I would have ever anticipated.
I think with the exception of a small handful of people, that's true of all of us. We've all benefited tremendously from it. So yeah, what a cool community. And it's growing all the time. So that's great to see. Okay. Thanks again. And let's try and reconnect soon. Appreciate it, Bill.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thank you again to Phil for spending some time with me, and to everybody else who's written in to discuss the Rome. If you are planning an Everesting Rome, whatever part of the world you are in, I'm totally interested to hear about it. So please hit me up at podcast@everesting.com. Would love to hear about it and how you're managing getting the meters in. Are you going to be doing repeats? Are you able to tack it all together as one single ride, perhaps a loop, an out and back? Whole bunch of different ways to take this on, and it's fun and interesting to chat about. So thanks for coming along for the ride. As we said at the beginning of the show, if you're able to give us a positive rating or review, that goes a long way to helping the podcast grow and find new listeners. So thank you for doing so. And lastly, thank you to the State Bicycle Company and to Quarry.